Dr. Iraj Abedian spent about two decades as a professor of economics, another two decades in the private sector running his own company. In between, he was very high profile in South Africa as the chief economist at Standard Bank. But he is Iranian. He comes from Iran. He grew up there. He did much of his early education there. And so if there's anyone in our country who's got their finger on the Iranian pulse, it's the good doctor. We'll find out from him today what is really going on there. We hear reports of thousands of people being shot by the regime. Iraj has told us time and again in the past that this is a regime that has around about 10% of the population supporting it. So is it going to be regime change? We'll find out in a moment. Iraj, from our conversations, it's a bit of a ticking time bomb. And that's why I'm so pleased that you come into the BizNews conference to give us an update, to do a keynote address. That's in March. But who knows what the situation will be like in March, given what's happened over the past couple of weeks.
Yeah. Greetings, Alec. Good talking with you again. And greetings to our viewers. Yeah, it is. Iran is sitting literally both the Iranian nation and the Iranian regime sitting on a knife edge, literally. In the next 3 days, much is expected to happen based on what President Trump has made announcements and commitments. Within the country, it is a war condition, a war between a nation that feels kept hostage, surrounded, and a regime that has increasingly, as I've said many times, and many, many hundreds of other better informed analysts globally have mentioned it over the past two decades, it's a regime that has lost total legitimacy, total efficacy in managing the country, and has gone beyond any moral, never mind religious, ethical bounds. Therefore, the regime is fighting for its own survival, and the nation, after 47 years and repeated uprising in under different pretexts or championing different causes, ranging from fair elections to women's rights to all kinds of real legitimate causes, this time around, the message is very different. It is not about legitimate or fair voter participation or voter counting. It's not about only women's rights. It is about life. People say they've had enough. We're not going to stay and die slowly. And the messages are quite stark and very clear. They say the regime must go. The dictator must stop and be toppled, and of course there is a whole spectrum of political stance. Those who cannot wait to take revenge after 40 years, some of them have lost many members, some of them are rotting in prisons, and of course what has also changed this time around, it is not just women or youth or rich or poor. It is for the first time from north to south, east to west, tribal affiliation, ideological affiliation, economic classes. You have for the first time the bazaar, which is the hub of conservative religious financiers of the regime in the early days and mobilizing against in their favor. They came out first in this case, simply because the currency is losing, it's on a free fall. Its economic implosion is a reality beyond even the most conservative bazaar traders and investors. So they started it. The university students joined. Intelligentsia has always been there, women and youth. In over 120 locations, not just major metros, right across the country, and non-stop for 16 days until Thursday last week. where the government realized that they're losing control. So what did they do? They literally cut off the country, held the nation hostage, and came out with live ammunition, mowing down barehanded protesters who were fighting, protesting for life and for their for regaining their own life.
You mentioned, Alec,
I get very, very obviously emotional. Yesterday, sure. I don't know how much you followed for the first time, a news agency, international news house, got access to an internal memo from the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, IRGC, reporting to the National Security Council, which is the president, the head of parliament, all the key members, giving their report that between Thursday and Friday, they have killed 12,000 of the protesters, the majority of whom, according to their reports, are young, below 30 years of age, kids involved. They have reported, which was also in the news 2 weeks ago, throwing tear gas in a hospital, two hospitals, one in Tehran, one in another city. So I think it has become a really incredibly, unbelievably horrific. And in the age of digital communication and so on, although Iran is literally blacked out or cut out from the rest of the globe, the nation is held hostage. Two more points, Alec. Within the so-called regime members, there is an absolute faction and friction, because even some of them cannot believe that in the name of religion, you can carry out this atrocity. And secondly, to the extent that the global community has now seen a different version of what Obama thought might be negotiable, might be persuaded to be humane. Europeans are rethinking, etc., etc. So I think it's a very, very tense, painful, and potentially very, very critical point for the region and for the Iranian nation.
It's an interesting point you make there about the memo that has now been, shown to the world, because you do mention that from Thursday there was an internet blackout, very little information coming out. We are seeing the occasional video of hundreds of thousands of people that are protesting taking to the streets. But on the ground, can you get hold of family? Can you get hold of people that you know in Tehran or other parts of Iran?
No, we cannot. Yesterday, the regime relaxed one-way telephone communication, not through internet, but through normal good old phones. Some people, in a random way, could call out, but nobody still can call in, and internet is completely blocked. And yesterday, I got a call from a distant family, a good friend, who said, "You're alive." And they could not talk any more than just that, because, as you can imagine, it's a war status, and everybody knows that the phones are tapped. In fact, the relaxation of partial telephone system was in part to gather intelligence as to who will call who will call Israel, who will call Mossad, who will call Trump, and et cetera, et cetera. So it's a very, very, literally, it's like a war zone, which prevailed on so many fronts. On the one hand, families who've lost, and remember, this is the official 12,000 who were shot dead at close range. They could count them. At the same time, thousands, possibly a multiple of that, as we speak, are in hospitals. Again, a fact yesterday, 4,000 Iranian doctors of different disciplines, they signed a statement to plead for global help for the patients, critical patients who have been shot in the head, in the body, wherever, shortage of medicine, lack of capacity in hospitals, etc., etc. And therefore, even when people call out, they are mindful that they are being tracked. So they could not give any information. And all they said, be okay at the moment. And this is hour by hour.
Iraj, the South African position, is this bemusing to you?
Honestly, Alec, if I want to be open about it, I can cry. I can cry for three, four reasons. One, at this point in time, after so many reports against a regime that has been by the United Nations, remember South Africa promotes multilateralism, adherence to the rules, compliance with the UN standards, and as opposed to unilateralism. So the United Nations has issued so many reports issuing written verdict that this regime has carried out crime against humanity, time and again. And as we speak, the same. I ask myself, why should the South African government, under the constitution that we have, under the constitution that ANC fought for and championed, why should the government violate its own constitutional mandate under which, within the framework of which, has to govern its local and international affairs? So that is a big, big issue. If it was 40 years ago, I can understand. But now, in 2025 and 2026, even close association with, on our own constitutional grounds, meaning human rights, women's rights, right of freedom of association, right of expressing your social preferences, the right to march legally, yes. But remember, the Iranian government for 47 years has refused to issue permits for peaceful demonstration. It hasn't been for lack of trying. Therefore, I ask myself, our department, our ministers, our people who we pay to collect intelligence, well-analyzed geopolitical conditions in order to guide our cabinet, what have they been thinking? That's one side that I really find it very confusing. Secondly, in terms of the global polarization, why the national interest can be possibly be seen as associating with the regime that, without a shadow of doubt, Alec, it's not just my conviction. Many, many well-informed, much better informed analysts, history will write this event and this regime as the Nazis of the 21st century. What we now see about Holocaust will be seen in much stronger, much more hateful analytics or perspective about this regime when the facts come out, when the truth, and the truth now is beginning to come out. So why would you want to be associating with a regime that is behaving that way, conducted itself that way, and that has become the hub of global terrorism, terrorizing its own nation? Remember, if you don't have mercy on your own nation, you'll have mercy on nobody. It's like yesterday I was thinking, what is happening in Iran? It's like when your immunity system within your body turns against you, you have autoimmune failures. This regime, the immunity, the government is supposed to protect the youth, the girls, the children, the authors, the everybody. It has turned against all of them, forcing them, putting military style of weapon in the streets, shooting them one by one without asking. There are cases where people were going to work to have been shot at a close range. I don't know if you've seen the clips that have been issued or released of body bags, where they are really piled them up like sausages. And I was crying just even now. I'm trying to be composed as much as I can. And it's not because they are my fellow Iranians, because they are human beings. I would do the same thing, and I did the same thing when Rwanda had going through genocides. I did the same thing when Gazans, Palestinians were being killed in Gaza. It's the same it is an issue of human rights more than anything else, first and foremost. And yet, in the best of judgment of our ministers, our cabinet, and our Department of Foreign Affairs or International Relations, they've come to the conclusion that it is okay to promote them. South Africa promoted Iran to BRICS, to all others, and gave them more legitimacy. The same way that President Obama gave them a plane load of cash to finance them since 2015. Now, what are we doing? Why?
Yeah.
Three weeks have gone. My last point, Alec. The South African government is quiet. It's why? 12,000 people were killed by their own admission in 48 hours. We are quiet. Our minister is quiet. Our president is quiet. Our parliament is quiet. Why? How do we explain that?
Let's move on to the Donald Trump factor here. He has been accused of the taco situation. In other words, Trump always chickens out. He's really put his neck on the line as far as this one is concerned. And there are some observers who say, well, the fact that Trump said, we will come to your aid, to the protesters, keep protesting, take over the institutions, means that they have got a backstop and they believe that America has their back. If we have another taco trade happening here, well, they certainly aren't going to be very happy about that. But how are you reading that situation, Iraj? Is it one of just sheer desperation that they'll believe anybody or take any sucker where they can? Or is Trump serious and likely to act?
Well, Alex, to be honest, I wish I knew. As you know, Trump only knows what Trump knows. And even his closest advisors oftentimes get surprised. So we don't know. But what we do know, whether Trump acts or not, the situation in Iran is such that, and often this is the analogy that used in the discourses amongst the specialists, it's like when you've been thrown into a deep well and you're stuck there. Somebody calls and says, can I pull you out? You don't ask who you are. You don't ask what's your orientation. Do people like you or they don't? You say yes. And that's exactly when a nation is held hostage, when Caspers and automatic guns are used against barehanded youth, women and children. Iran at the moment is in a catch-22. On the one hand, and this is a competing morality. On the one hand, the Israelis and the Trump did not start this. It is started by the Bazaaris. It is started, as I mentioned earlier, I don't want to repeat it. It's a home revolution. Ordinarily, the nation, the government would have responded in some way or another, engaged them. They didn't. Instead, they blacked out, blocked them, and mowed them down, literally. So if the Trump and the Israelis and whoever else comes into their support, the regime would jump and say, yeah, look, this is the evidence. You were the agents of Trump or the agents of the Israelis. So the local movement on that ground wants to retain its independence, wants to say, we want our lives back. Not because Trump is financing us or arming. They don't have any arm in any case. So on the other hand, they've fallen into that well. And there's only one way that they can survive now. And that is if, ideally, the United Nations Security Council could and should, in my view, invoke the clause that is part of their mandate, the clause, the duty to care. When the immunity system fails, when a government turns the guns and Caspers against its nation, it's the duty of the international community through the Security Council to collectively act against it. But you and I know that the United Nations and Security Council is dysfunctional. China, Russia, US, UK, they have their own agenda. So the likelihood of that happening whilst every hour a few more thousands are being killed, not because they are demonstrating, because now the government literally knocks at doors, hunt them down in hospitals, at workplace, everywhere that they can find them. So somebody has to do something. And the only one that appears to have either the courage of his conviction or political agenda for whatever reason is President Trump. Europeans are quiet. Non-aligned countries such as South Africa, India, and the rest, who always beat their chest about non-alignment, they are absolutely dead quiet. So who is left? China is a beneficiary of the situation in Iran, because Iran has acted for now 20 more years as a cheap petrol station for them. Therefore, they are going to be quiet. Russia is quiet and will remain quiet because Iran supplies them with dirt cheap ammunition. So, and the West, amongst the Western bloc, so to speak, and non-aligned countries, the only president who has at least expressed some sympathy for this mass killing is President Trump. So this competing morality, then Iranian at the moment say, if Trump is the only game in town, please come and pull us out of this slow death in this deep well.
Raj, what about the other South African connection here, MTN? It is the 49% shareholder of Irancell, which is the dominant cell phone company. It has been, has admitted, as you've said on our channel before in our conversations, you said, well, MTN can't get its money out. It's a hostage there. Now the CEO, Ralph Mopita, who must now be wondering whether he should have stayed at Old Mutual, is saying the same thing. We can't get it out. It seems as though if there is to be regime change, on the one hand, MTN will have to write that off because surely it will be seen as a collaborator. And on the other hand, if there isn't regime change, well, it'll be perceived as supporting this kind of brutality. It's a no-win situation. Maybe when Naspers, when the Russians invaded Ukraine, Naspers sold everything that it had in Russia and extricated itself from that situation. Perhaps if you were on MTN's board, you'd be advising them to look at things differently?
Absolutely. I think, Alec, just one point, if this regime falls or not, that is, the regime will fall, is absolutely no doubt. Whether it will fall in the next 3 days, 12 months or 3 years, that's the question. So if I'm sitting on the board of any company, MTN, you mentioned, I would say, look, this is a cul-de-sac we find ourselves in. Therefore, cut your losses and align yourself away from the dictators, from the oppressors, from the Holocaust of the 21st century, and rescue what is left of your brand. That's how I would go about it. I would look at it from a risk-weighted decision-making and not from a time-bound factor. MTN has lost credibility in many quarters. If this regime falls, which is a matter of inevitability of national and historic imperative, it's just a question of time. At that time, MTN will have absolutely no ground for claiming anything. And in fact, the nation will, in my view, raise claim against MTN as the collaborators for many of its deaths, the same way that the Jews did against many, many organizations and companies in Europe. So there is a precedence for it. And you can rest assured, and MTN can rest assured, that there will be future claim against this. And I've been very, very open with them over the past 5-6 years in private and in public, saying you are not managing the shareholders' interest properly. You are continuing buying time, hoping for Gaza to arrive, and it's not going to happen. They were hoping that Qatar would, as an intermediary, buy their shares, house it in a, or hold it in a blind trust, and they will then exit themselves. That also did not work out, and it will not work out. So I'm extremely disappointed at the board of MTN, not just the CEO. The entire board has, in my view, failed its ESG principles. number one. It has failed the custodianship of the interests of its shareholders by not looking at the situation realistically, going politically. I can understand political alignments forcing them to stay, but I cannot see them in terms of their fiduciary responsibility, particularly as a listed entity with respect to their ESG principles.
I guess the big question for many people is why now? You had the 2022 uprising that was due to a young woman who was arrested for not wearing a headscarf, and she died in police custody, and people got very angry, justifiably there. But this is all about economics. And when it is founded on economics, when revolutions or unrest is based on economics, is it likely to be more successful, or does history say it's more successful than when it is perhaps on a different base that people are angry?
Yes, Alec, two reasons why this is different from the past. One is that this is not an sporadic or unconnected incidents. This is the culmination of 30 years of attempts and trials and learning by the society collectively. As I mentioned earlier, this is the first time in 47 years that all the strata of the society, young and old, tribal, etc., have coalesced, because it began with the implosion of the currency. Even the rich, or those who said, be okay, be comfortable, it's the working class that's suffering, but I'm not going to upset my earnings and my wealth. Their wealth and their income disappeared within 3 days. The currency lost 46% of its value within 4 days. When your wealth disappears like that, trade comes to standstill. Remember, Iran is a trading nation. It imports just about everything, from food to medicine to whatever. Now, if you're a trader, a wholesaler, your imported value goes up by 46, 50%, and your demand disappears. You can't even sell because you don't know how you're going to replace it. And if you replace it, how are you going to sell it? Many, many small, medium, very relatively successful businesses disappeared within 10 days. And I know many of them before this outbreak or revolution movements. So businesses suddenly lost their value, incomes lost value, shortage of food, as we speak, shortage of cooking oil, eggs, chicken, you name it. And the government, and this is not accusation, it's on luckily recorded, the president went from province to province the week before this uprising to say, look, as a government, we can't do anything. We don't have a solution. If anybody has got a solution, please, my office is open, come and help us to find the solution. There is shortage of water, there is shortage of electricity, there is shortage of food stuff, medicine and so on, and salaries for the pensioners and many of the public servants are not paid on time. Now, if you have that situation, economics is like when you have a massive heap of dead wood, dry, something sparks the fire. The spark was the economic one, but the problem is bigger, wider, and more chronic than economics. It was lack of life, lack of future. The youth are saying, we have two choices, either die slowly and miserably or die with a bullet. They have now said, we're out. If it's a bullet, we take the bullet.
It's extraordinary.
The second thing that's different, Alec, I'm sorry if I'm being figurative, I'm just copying what I hear from those who are in the streets. And I'm also confused as to what is so different. The second and very important thing that is different, up to now, people have been fighting for a cause, women or proper voting, counting, etc. This time, they say, we don't want this regime. We want this dictator to go. We want Islamic government to disappear from the face of our country. In fact, the message is, until these are buried, Iran cannot be freed. And this is different. And of course, what other thing which is different, up to now, they've been saying what we don't like. This time, for the first time, they also say what we want. They've seemed to be rallying around the Shah's son, whatever his power base, and nobody knows. I have no clue as to whether his power base is 50%, 30%, or 10%. But what he has positioned himself is, I do not want to be a monarch. I do not want to be a president. I want to be the coordinating, leading agent for transition from this horrible, unsustainable, torturous situation to whatever the nation wants. Now, this is also different. And that's a very, very important development that we have to watch and see where it goes.
The world is changing so quickly, Iraj, and of course we are focusing attention on Iran. But if you go back just over a year when we had the revolution in Bangladesh, it was also the youth who said we'd had enough. They stood, and I heard this from the person who's actually leading the facilitation, a little bit like the Shah's son once could be doing in Iran in the future. And he was saying that the young people were standing in the streets being shot by the Bangladeshi security forces. And as one dropped, another one took their place. It appears as though sometimes the sacrifices that are being made are really, really extreme. But you start with Bangladesh, you have a look at what's going on in Iran. You see so many places in the world and a lot of sub-Saharan Africa where elections have been stolen, where the public have just kind of sat back and accepted it. Does it have to get, you're an economist, you're a professor of economics, does it have to get to a point where the rich start getting hurt for the whole society then to pick up the cudgels and go for a better future?
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because it's not about Iran. It's about a global situation where different institutions within the society, most importantly, the institution of business, investment community, they have become less and less involved and worried about the socio-political trends, because they are making so much money, because they are counting their dollars, so to speak, and their bank accounts or their balance sheets. Therefore, they are not paying attention to the slow but inevitable brewing of social instability, the abuse of democracy even, abuse of voting system, abuse of governance system, etc., etc. And that is where the social immunity that I referred to, when the social immunity begins to fail against the masses can only tolerate so much, 20 years, 30 years, 5 years, depending on the history and the composition of the nation. I see this is a pattern that is emerging when the different competing and contesting institutions within the society, they let go of their responsibility. You cannot have a government not abiding by its own constitutional principle. You cannot, by the same token, have a business community, the capitalist, the investment community, with enormous amount of power, the power of job creation, the power of growth generation, tax generation, prosperity generation, to abdicate their responsibility by being silent. And by being silent, you become complicit in the mismanagement of the economy. You become complicit in the unethical corruption, everything else that goes on. It is not that they are not involved. It's when they are silent, they become complicit in the slow and very, very corrosive mismanagement or missteps that politicians engage in. That's part of the contributing factors. And of course, in the age of digital communication, the youth whose future is being traded on these altars of being politically correct or being this or being that or being taking care of myself, I don't care about others, they can see what's happening. It's no longer you and I can cover it up or justify it. They look into your eyes and they say, you are trading my future away. You are taking away my opportunities, my life. And therefore, comes a point where in Bangladesh, where in Iran, back now, and elsewhere, It wasn't so that far back that Kenya did the same thing. They stood to the government that thought, we are government and we do what we like and we will beat the hell out of you if you know. They pushed back. Yes, there were some casualties, but the president had to back off. the Minister of Finance had to back off. So I think that's the reality of what I call it, the inversion of power pyramid. We are used to a pyramid that the power at the top rules the masses. Now this pyramid, because of technological and a whole lot of other developments, the pyramid has been inverted. But those who are in power, they don't see it. They don't want to believe it. They don't want to humble themselves to the reality that they cannot trade people's lives and their futures on the back of their corrupt and misguided imaginations or practices.
An ideology. But bring it back home then. You've spoken at some length about the way that the South African government has been backing very much the wrong horse in this case. Is this a situation similar to what you were discussing earlier, where the pyramid has been inverted, but those who are now on the bottom don't realize it?
Absolutely. And in fact, locally, we can see that our municipality is a good example of it, is completely mismanaged. In fact, they've become the agent of against the national interest. They just don't know it. They're so confused. They're at the bottom of this pyramid. They're under pressure. The masses are swearing at them, disrespecting them, and yet they still hold the office. The emperor's got no clothes, and the only one who doesn't know is the emperor himself. The mayor of Johannesburg still thinks that he can decree and people will just accept. Or some of the decisions that these mayoral committees make, I'm absolutely shocked as a citizen, as an economist, as a student of social science, that they don't see some of the decisions that national government makes. There is no attention to what it takes for the nation to succeed, despite all the opportunities that we have. Instead, what do? They go and align themselves with a country like Iran, or they go and come up with something that is corrupt and abusive and extract resources from the nation. This is where a reality must somehow be discussed, that the power pyramid is inverted for good. The youth are not going to buy the old ideology. We need to have a different discourse. The definition of the minister's job description must change. The president must have a different job description, and we need to have a different kind of engaging with the citizens. I am linking it back to Iran. I'm absolutely shocked that the president and the government of South Africa has not actually acknowledged that there is a massacre going second to none in the 21st century. They know it. There's no question about it. Our ambassador there, if he hasn't responded and reported, then he should be sacked from his office. And yet, the government, the cabinet, the coalition cabinet is quiet. It's not about ANC anymore. It's about how we as South Africans honor our own constitutions. How do we pay attention to our nation's reality? And how do we join our total capabilities in business, in government, intelligentsia, elsewhere to uplift the lived reality, not political statement, the lived reality of our citizens? That is missing at the moment. There's a lot of statements by all political parties, a lot of ambitious objectives, et cetera, et cetera. But nothing operationally that would change the lived reality next year this time, or 2 years from now, or 6 months from now.
But Iraj, the man in the street in South Africa is also pretty confused, because the message that's coming through to South Africans is that the West is wrong. Everything that the West is doing is incorrect. Donald Trump is the personification of all that's bad, the schoolyard bully who is beating up on South Africa. Now, why should we have to pay an additional 25% tariff? Because we're friends with Iran, because Iran actually is a good nation to be friends with. And that's what many people really and truly do believe. It's their truth. So how does one address that?
I think the only way that we can address it is to bring out the truth, not manipulated own facts. For example, we need to have a discussion as to is Iran or Iran regime, not Iranian nation, big difference. Is the Iranian regime a regime that is compliant and compatible with our social objectives and our constitution? Yes, no, and bring the competing views. And not my view or somebody else's view, bring the facts out. If we are if we are in the environment that we are, that the United Nations is failing, multilateralism has come to an end because it has not reformed itself, and therefore there is a gravitation towards polarization, whether you are pro-China, pro-Russia, pro-Trump, anti-Trump, doesn't matter. If that's the case, how do we take care of our nation's interests? Is it that we align ourselves with one but not the other? Or is it that we openly come out and say, we are against tyranny, no matter if it happens in Russia, in China, or in the United States? We can't take part. We got to be principles driven. We need to be facts driven. Chinese have been oppressing the Muslim population for years by their own admission, trying to reconvert them. Inhuman. I would not go about that way, but that's their choice. We have South African government being quiet on that. Syria. We've had discussed this before, and it's a fact. Syria wipes out 700,000 people, almost 10 times more than what Israelis wiped out in Gaza. The South African government up to today has issued nothing. 7 million were displaced across Europe. South Africa was completely happy to have not conversation about it in our parliament. We issued nothing. You go to Sudan and South Sudan, as we speak, people are being traumatized, killed daily. We are quiet about it. So do we now go and align ourselves with BRICS or with East or with West? No, we got to have a conversation based on truth. The truth is that the West has got its problems, huge problems. The East has got, if you're a nation like South Africa, you cannot, should not align yourself because you're on a losing track, whatever side you choose, because you don't know, you're not big enough. You're not resourceful enough. You're not stable enough, internally speaking. If you look at the level of poverty and unemployment in South Africa, all our politicians over the past 20 years have written again and again that we are sitting on a time bomb. Well, what have you done about it? Nothing. And we have one catchphrase, which is called implementation failure, which if you translate it in economic terms, means incompetence to implement, incompetence to do things. And minister, president after president says, no, we have good policies, but we have implementation failure, which means we haven't appointed the competent people. We don't know what we should do. We don't know how to monitor. We are not doing it. We're failing time and time again. Now, if you're a vulnerable nation like that, you don't take sides with one or the other because you're not big enough. So I think the way to do it, Alec, is to be truthful, to put the facts on the table, and be honest with the nation that we have limitations in global geopolitics, but we're going to focus on changing your lived reality. And that means sometimes we will be working with everybody and we refuse to be anybody's back pocket, no matter what the principle might be. We are not doing that. We're playing philosophy, ideology, and ambitions without having the right grounding in our own nation.
Well, Iraj, you remind me that we have such deep wisdom in our country. It's not for lack of brain power that we can't get this right. But you have waved some very big flags, and God bless the Iranians and everything that's happening there. And at the end, one does know that there's nothing more powerful than the truth, and that the truth will prevail. And one believes that even Pretoria will come to that realization in due course. Iraj Abedian is a former professor of economics. He was born and raised in Iran. He is the founder of Pan-African Capital. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.